started to speak yesterday about F, the rise of Darwinism. And this is one of the great turning points in history. It is not a great turning point so much because of the idea as because of the effect which they had upon the world. Previously, we have had periods when the great mass of people were thoroughly convinced of the truth of the Bible. And we've had periods when the great masses were utterly indifferent and turned almost completely away from it. We saw the great change in England between the time of Puritan ascendancy from 1650 to 1660 and the time in around 1700 and later when there was hardly a Puritan left in the country, when the whole mass of the people was sunk in debauchery and in drunkenness, and when the ministers were reading the prayer book and reading from the scripture, and some of them truly believing and having a little group of real believers around them, but most of them engaged in fox hunting and gambling and drinking, and there's no reality to it. We have these great changes, one direction and another. But Darwinism brought in a great movement that affected thought of the world as a whole. It did not, like so many great unchristian thinkers before, affect a few people of intellectual type who loved to ponder and to think and who were led off in one direction or the other and would be led back by another writer. It reached out and affected the great masses of the people. And therefore, it is one of the great forces in our present civilization is the effect of Darwinism. And so, in church history, it is wise that we should know a little bit about how it came, about the forces which gave it its effectiveness. It is not so important for this class, of course, if we go into the scientific evidences. We may glance at a few of them. But that is not our particular purpose in this particular class. But to see it as a force, to see its tremendous effect, to see how it moves, to see something of its nature. And so yesterday I spoke, number one, of evolution before Darwin. And I mentioned that there were evolutionary ideas among some of the Greeks. And I mentioned that Darwin's own grandfather wrote a great long poem presenting evolutionary theory that everything proceeded from one very simple beginning, like gradual changes to develop the world as it is. And a few people who were already disposed in that direction read his poem and enjoyed it. Much more important is Lamarck in France. He's a great student of biology who had a fully developed theory of evolution, which he presented and which won a few followers, a few thinkers in the biological realm thought Lamarck had some excellent ideas. Most were glad for some advances he's made in certain areas of science, but put down his theories in general as sort of an interesting speculation that the man had engaged in. But before we go on to see actually what happened in the coming of Darwinism, we should glance at a man who had a great effect in a way he never would have dreamed of upon the effect of Darwin. And that we call number two, just at the end of the hour, I said Linnaeus. L-I-N-N-A-E-U-S. This is Latinized form. He was a Swede, Carl von Linné, but he changed his name to Carolus Linnaeus for his scientific writings. Most scientific writings were still in Latin in those days. He lived from 1707 to 1778. He was a firm believer in the Bible, a great Christian man, and also a very great scientist. And he was a scientist who won a recognition throughout our Western world. When English ships would come to some part of the Americas on some business for the king, if they would see a new type of plant or a new type of insect that they had never seen before, they would gather a specimen and take it back in order that it be sent to Linnaeus. People from all Western countries were interested in the great work of Linnaeus. and were interested in bringing him new specimens. And he made a more extensive list of the various types of plants than anyone had ever done up to that time. But of course, Linnaeus's great contribution was not simply in gathering material, it was in the way he arranged it. He is considered as the originator of the modern system of taxonomy, that is to say, of classification. Linnaeus hit upon the idea that everything in the world, every living thing, consists of a certain kind of thing. He took the Latin word kind, species, and so he decided to call it a species. And then he took another Latin word for kind, genus, and he said these kinds are apt to group together. You'll find a number of them that are rather similar, and we'll call that a genus. And he invented the idea of having each one given a double name. First the name of the genus, and the next the name of the species. I came across a rattlesnake once in the Grand Canyon, which I thought was different than anything I'd ever heard of before. So I thought maybe they'd call it Cotylus macriensis, because I was the one who had discovered it. However, I found someone else that already had come across this type, so its proper name is Cotylus molossus molossus, instead of Cotylus macriensis. Franklin D. Roosevelt had an octopus named after him. I forget the Latin word for the genus octopus, but then there's the word for this, they say Rooseveltiensis or something, for this particular species. Now, Linnaeus developed this system, and then the genera, the plural genus, he grouped together in larger groupings. I'm not sure that he originated the whole system used today with the upper groups called families and orders and classes and so on, going right up to kingdom. Parts of it, at least, I know he used. But a system eventually was developed, which all recognize is based upon the idea Linnaeus developed, and particularly this thing of having a double name, naming the genus and the species, the Latin name for every type of thing. And Linnaeus said, each of these kinds is a definite, separate creation of God. God created plants and said that he created them, it says in Genesis, after their kind. And it says he created the animals after their kind and ordered them to reproduce. And so Linnaeus said the kind of Genesis is what he called a species. Now, one of the sad things in history is that time after time, people take the theory of the scientific theory of a certain period, and they read it into the Bible, and often they give it as a wonderful evidence of the accuracy of the Bible, that the particular scientific theory that is widely accepted in their day fits with certain statements in the Bible. And so they say, this is a proof the Bible is accurate, this theory here. You find the Bible knew all along. But then if the theory is disproved in the next generation, and a different theory takes its place, then people say, look how wrong the Bible is. The Bible taught this, and we now know it isn't true. Well, actually, if the Bible teaches it, and people say it's now disproven, let's just wait until they get more evidence, and they'll find it was true after. But if it's something you've simply read into the Bible, or shown that it doesn't contradict the Bible, or tried to twist the Bible words a little bit to make them fit with it, you may increase faith at a particular time, but you are laying the foundation for real damage to be done later if it's proven untrue. I remember back very vividly, back in 1940, when Hitler made his non-aggression pact with Stalin. And I heard many people say, just look how prophecy is being fulfilled. See how accurate the Bible is here. Because you read about the end times and about the Confederation of the North and about the nations in the South, which they said must correspond to the Roman Empire. And the Roman Empire's borders did not include Germany. And yet, Germany was definitely thought of by most of us, along with our Western nations, as distinct from Russia. Now they said Russia and Germany are together against the countries that formerly were in the Roman Empire. What a wonderful proof, they said, of the accuracy of the Bible. And then one day Hitler turned against Germany, against Russia, and Russia lined up with the Western powers, as they had to in self-defense, and the people who had been moved somewhat toward seeing the marvelous accuracy of the Bible naturally said, look at here, how foolish. The Bible teaches Russia and Germany will be together and now they're at each other's throats. Actually, of course, the Bible gives us some ideas of events in the end time, but whether they are today or a long time from now, nobody knows with certainty. But people said it fits with the Bible, then said it's what the Bible teaches, and then when people showed it wasn't what, that the events didn't fit with it, it certainly did much more harm than good. Well, Linnaeus said the species that he considered a species, that is a distinct, separate creation of God, and there never can be a progress or change from one of these species into another species, because God created them after their time. And so Bible believers took up the science of a certain particular period. And then when a little later, or in a different generation, science rejects that particular theory, they may hold to the science of a previous generation and say that's what the Bible teaches, when it isn't at all. It's merely read into the Bible. But by the time when Darwinism came along, by that time, the Christian world as a whole, thank you very much, had gratefully accepted Linnaeus' theory. And even those who knew nothing about Christianity were very strongly convinced of the fixity of speech. Now, the Bible does teach that God created animals and plants after their kind, and that these procreate after their kind. But it nowhere says a kind is what Linnaeus means by a species. And today there is great argument and discussion among biologists as to the correct definition of a species. And certain things that were formerly thought to be one species are now being divided into several. And certain that formerly were thought to be several are being put together into one with subspecies or varieties. To say that the present theory on that is what the Bible teaches is simply reading into the Bible. But this was very widely held to be biblical teaching by the time of Darwin, that the Linnaeus species is the kind in the Bible. Well, now the Bible says there are distinct kinds. And God created these distinct kinds. And these kinds don't change into one another. But how big is a kind? The Bible doesn't say. Did God make 10 different kinds? Did he make 100 kinds? Did he make 2 million kinds? The Bible does not say. And when we read into the Bible, we make the strong possibility of the next generation disproving the science of this generation or the theories of this generation or ideas in this generation and then leading people to think that the Bible was wrong all along. Well, toward the end of his life, Linnaeus began to have questions as to whether a species really was the kind in the Bible. He said, maybe it is the genus, not the species, that is the kind in the Bible, toward the end of his life. But that got comparatively little attention. And people that don't know much about it today will insist that Linnaeus always believed the kind in the Bible was the species. It is a fact, though, that a generation after Linnaeus wrote, practically all scientists believe that the species is the kind mentioned in the Bible. Practically all Bible believers, the Bible teachers, took that for granted. Now, just a little bit of thought will show us how silly it would be the idea that everything reproduces after its exact image. No child is exactly like its parent. Adam and Eve were the progenitors of the human race. But today, you'll find tremendous variety in the human race. You have some are very tall, some are very short. Some have blue eyes, some have brown eyes, some have green eyes. You have tremendous variety within the human race, all coming from one original parent. Or an illustration that often occurs to me, look at a little caterpillar crawling on the ground. You see that little caterpillar crawling along with its sharp teeth, chewing up those hard leaves for its food. And then you look a little distance away and you see a beautiful butterfly flying above. It has no teeth, or if it has, there are the tiniest little remains of teeth. It doesn't use teeth. It sucks moisture out of the flower. And it would be hard to think of two things more utterly different in their appearance, in their habits, in the type of food they use, in many different ways, than a caterpillar and a butterfly. And yet, if you simply watch that caterpillar for a certain length of time, you would find that the time comes when it changes into the butterfly. Tremendous change. If you never saw them change, you certainly think, these aren't two different species. These aren't even two different genus, two different genera. These are different families or different orders. They are so utterly different. And yet that occurs in the life cycle of the butterfly or moth and of the caterpillar, which changes into it. And there are many species in this group that does this. There is great variety in the world. And God has created the world with a tremendous complexity beyond anything that we can imagine, what the Bible definitely teaches we can stand upon. But when we start reading into it, we are apt to go astray. But it was unfortunate that this idea of the fixity of species had become so established that people felt, well, the Bible teaches it. Every Christian has got to believe that. And the very idea of there being the possibility of a species developing out of another species was something that simply seemed utterly atheistic and fantastic to most Christians in Darwin's early days. The development from one kind into another kind certainly is ruled out by the Bible, but it doesn't tell us how many kinds. And we do not advance Christian thought by assuming something that the Bible doesn't teach. Well, Linnaeus, then, was a great scientist, made great contributions to the thought of of science, and he was a great Christian, but he did great harm to the Christian movement by leading people to infer certain scientific things taught in the Bible, which are not taught there, and therefore leading them to feel that if this is broken down, then you simply can discard the Bible. Well, number three, Darwin's first 50 years. Darwin's first 50 years. I'm not going to speak of all of his 50 years under this head, because the latter ones are going to want to speak under a different head. But it's interesting to remember that Darwin was born in 1509, the same year that Abraham Lincoln was born, and that it was exactly 50 years later, in 1859, that he wrote his Origin, or he published his Origin of Species. And Darwin, who was born in 1809, Darwin was the grandson of Erasmus Darwin. Darwin's father was a physician, a good deal of a psychologist, a man who kept his anti-Christian ideas largely to himself, but who had a great disinterest in Christianity and in the church. But Darwin's father was very much concerned about his son, who didn't seem to him to be willing to settle down and do anything worthwhile. He said, "You never do anything but chase rats and collect different kinds of little animals, and you waste your time on all this nonsense." He said, "Why don't you settle down and do something worthwhile? Why don't you become a physician. And so Darwin eventually did what his father wanted and went up to Edinburgh to study to be a physician. And psychologists think that a good bit of Darwin's patient, steady, hard work in the latter part of his life can be attributed to his feeling The way he was affected by his father's disgust at his seeming careless ways in his youth, as if he was trying to make up to his father. Was anything to that or not, I don't know. But at least he went up as a young man to Edinburgh and studied there a couple of years and thoroughly disliked it. He said in later years, he said that in 1830, about 1830, I forget the exact year, that a professor would say, the last time I visited Paris in 1715, such a thing occurred. And he felt the man was simply reading from his predecessor, his father's lecture. Maybe he was wrong, maybe he made a slip of the tongue and actually meant 1815. I don't know. But that shows at least the attitude that Darwin took toward it. And so he came home and he told his father how thoroughly he disliked the study of Edinburgh, and he thoroughly disliked the idea of being a doctor, and his father said, well, why don't you go into the church? Well, Darwin said, that's a good profession, to be in the church, to be a rector, to lead the services. But he said, I'm not sure, the boy said, that I can conscientiously do it. He said, of course, I have no doubt everything in the Bible is true, the Bible is God's word. But he says, I don't know about the deity of Christ. I'm not sure I could accept that doctrine. And he said, a minister is supposed to accept that doctrine. So he spent a bit of time considering before he decided he would be willing to say yes to that doctrine. And then he went to Cambridge. And he took courses there, preparatory to being a minister, but he came into contact with some of the leading scientists of the day. And these men who were interested in biology and botany and in geology interested him greatly. And he began going with them, collecting specimens and taking an interest in what they were doing. And then he finished his course at Cambridge, and he thought of looking about for a place as a rector of a church. But there was a ship just going to sail, a British ship, to spend 5 years on a more or less exploratory trip visiting Africa and South America and different islands on the way. The ship called the Beagle, B-E-A-G-L-E, a name that has become famous in scientific lore. And he was the captain of the ship, wanted to, along with the rough sailors, ignorant sailors who were on the boat, he wanted to have an intelligent man who would be company for himself. And a man of education, a man of culture, a gentleman, and he got in touch with one of the professors and said, could you come along as natural on this trip? And the professor said, I couldn't do that. He said, I have my lecture to give at Cambridge. But he said, there's a young fellow here, just graduated, who is greatly interested in natural things. Why don't you ask young Charles Darwin? So they invited Charles Darwin. And for 5 years, he went on the trip on the Beagle, which visited many parts of Africa and of South America. He went along as naturalist. Really, the captain wanted a gentlemanly company, was perhaps the real purpose, but Darwin took it very seriously, that he was going as naturalist, and tried to study the conditions, the geological, the botanical and the zoological conditions of the places where he went. And he saw many very interesting things. He was a bright young fellow who wrote them up in a very interesting way. And he says later that he had no doubt whatever of the fixity of species at the time. No doubt. And even occasionally when there were certain discussions on the boat about certain statements in the Bible, he says he would argue for these statements, and this greatly pleased the captain, who himself was a very ardent believer in the Bible, Captain Fitzroy. But Darwin made this trip on the Beagle. For 5 years, it was a miserable trip because he could not stand the ocean. And as soon as, of course, those little boats, I don't know whether any of us could have stood the ocean in the boats they had in those days. But during the 5 years, he never got used to it. As soon as the boat got out of sight of land, he was deadly sick and remained so until they stopped again. at another island or another ship. Some people think he ruined his health for life by this. Others say that his sickness was psychosomatic nowadays. Probably there's a little element of both in it. But he was interested enough in his observation that he put up with his miserable seasickness on the voyages. But when they would land, he was off going inland as far as he could, observing things and studying them. And he found, particularly on certain islands, a few hundred miles off the coast of South America, he found birds which were very similar to birds in South America, and yet a little different. And there were these little differences which he found on this island. And now he said, can I quite believe that the Creator made these birds on this island just like this, and made the birds in South America so similar but a little different, and I've never seen birds anywhere else just like these. Now, isn't it more reasonable to say that a couple of birds sometimes made the trip, got blown by the wind or something from South America, further than birds of that type usually fly, and landed on this island, and then staying on this island for a long, long period, separate from there, that gradually they developed in a different way from the one in South America. Isn't that more reasonable? And he began to have doubts of the fixity of species. But of course, the Bible nowhere says that Leviathan's species are fixed. God created different kinds, but how big are the kinds? There certainly is development and change within the kinds, as we see among almost any of us. Take any two of us, and you will find great differences between them, which have developed in the course of time. You take a group of people and you leave them in any one section of the world for a few hundred years without much connection with people in other sections, and you find that little differences begin to be evident between them and other areas. Of course, nobody doubts that all human beings are one species. We have so very much in common. But there are these little changes. And when these changes become large enough to call it a different species or even a different genus, does that mean that it's wrong that God created according to different kinds, or simply that we have not understood just how large the kinds were? Well, Darwin on the trip began to question a little bit whether all these hundreds of thousands species. I believe they say today there are about 2 million species of animals and a few hundred thousand of plants, or is it reversed? I forget. But at any rate, it's a very large number. And Darwin began to think, now there's more difference between them. And then there was an Englishman named Lyell, for whom Darwin had very great respect, L-Y-L-E. And Lyell was a great pioneer in geology. And Lyell wrote a series of books which he called his Principles of Geology. And these books were shipped to Darwin during the trip. And when he would receive the next volume of Lyell's Principles of Geology, L-Y-E-L-L, he was very greatly thrilled to receive it and read it with great care. And Lyell discussed the findings of remains of ancient animals and evidences that suggested to him that the earth was much more than 4,000 years old. And of course, Archbishop Usher had made a very clever guess that the world was created just 4,000 years before Christ was born, but it's only a guess. The Bible doesn't tell us how old the earth is. We do not know. God has not given us that information. The Bible doesn't tell us how long ago Adam was created. But when people fasten onto the Bible a specific idea that the Bible does not give, when they fasten that idea onto it, then, naturally, if people find scientific evidence that doesn't fit with that idea, it makes them think the Bible is in error. Well, Darwin returned from his trip, and the thought of his being in the church had completely disappeared. It just was dropped. He was interested in science. He went to London. He became a secretary of a scientific society. He married his cousin, the daughter of Josiah Wedgwood of the Wedgwood Pottery. So whenever you buy Wedgwood Pottery, you are contributing to the source that gave Darwin his ability to have leisure and time to compose his theory. But he married her and settled down in London for 3 or 4 years, very brief time. And then he bought himself an estate outside of London, some little distance away, and he moved there and spent most of the rest of his life there. But he was hardly back from the trip before he began to have these recurrent illnesses. Every day he was ill, it seemed, part of the day. Every day he would go to bed for some hours during the day. And he used to say how he regretted that he missed so much of the new novel that came out. Because his wife would read to him as he lay in bed, and she didn't want to wake him up by quitting reading, so she'd keep right on reading. And so he never knew whether he had missed 10 minutes or 2 hours of the particular novel. But all the new novels that came out, she read through to him. And the time he spent in bed, he was on the verge of illness all the time. He did very little traveling. But the time that he felt decent, he worked hard as he could. And he put in about 4 hours at least every day of really hard work, and sometimes more. And he was greatly interested in the comparison of different animals and plants and in any theories he could make about them. He became friends with some very fine scientists, especially younger men who looked up to him greatly. And he stayed right there at his home and continued on this work. Now, he spent 10 years studying barnacles. You know, the barnacles are little things that fasten on the hulls of boats, and they have to pull them off every so often or they will destroy the boat. He had 10,000 barnacles sent to his home there, and he spent 10 years working on them, comparing them, measuring them, dividing them into species and so on. And people were amused at this, and there was a play in England about which had a scientist in it who had spent 20 years studying some particular very small animal, and everybody knew that it was Charles Darwin who they were making fun of as the man who did this slow, steady, methodical work of this type. Now, and number four, the origin of the origin of species. The origin of the origin of species. Very soon after Darwin came back from his trip on the Beagle, while he was working on his journal, which was published, and he published a few scientific works during these years, which a few scientists read and enjoyed. They were well written and had a lot of carefully prepared, carefully gathered evidence in them. One day, he went back to a book he had read while a divinity student. It was Malthus, an English clergyman of 50 years before, had written a book on discussion of population. And Malthus said, population increases faster than food supply. And therefore, he said, if it were not for wars and pestilences and other things that cut down the number of people, we would soon all be starving. And he presented the quandary of his thought between the increase in population going so much faster than the increase in the food supply. The book by this clergyman, Malthus, had won a very wide hearing. It's been reprinted many times. And Darwin, as he read the book, the thought suddenly occurred to him, well, there's the explanation of the difference in the birds in the Galapagos Islands and on the coast of South America. There's the difference, he said. All the children that are born differ from each other a little bit. And, he said, the kinds that fit with their environment naturally can thrive better, and the others are apt to die off. And so there's a gradual change that occurs. And thus we have, out of one species, gradually, seriously developing. And he said that way, doubtless everything has developed just by these gradual changes. I was looking at a book just recently by a great scientist at the University of Pennsylvania on the history of evolution. He had a chart in it showing Lamarck's theory. And the chart showed Lamarck's theory, he showed giraffe. And then the giraffe was reaching, trying to get the leaves high up on the tree. And according to Lamarck, this man said, there was a desire on the part of the giraffe to reach, to get to the, there was a desire to get higher. And that way the giraffe develops higher, longer neck. But he said, Darwin's theory, there's no desire, there's no purpose, there's nothing like that in it at all. Darwin's theory is, there are many giraffes here, but some are a little taller than them. And the ones taller can get some more leaves, they have healthier lives, they live longer, and they produce more children. And consequently, over the period, they gradually get a little longer and a little longer until eventually you have the short giraffes die off and the tall ones last. And so Darwin developed this theory, and he wrote 3 or 4 pages about it, and he thought it was such a clever idea, he put it away in a safe. And then 2 or 3 years later, he took it out, and he wrote a paper that would be maybe 40 pages long, expanding this theory. And he locked it up in the safe, and he said, as soon as I get time, I'm going to write a long discussion of this, maybe 3,000 pages long, going into all the details and ramifications of it. But he didn't get to that. 20 years or so passed, and it was still in his state. But he was always thinking about it a little and talking with people, suggesting it to them. He met a young man named Huxley. And this man, young Huxley, who was interested, he was a physician, was interested in the nature of the human race, and Darwin suggested to him about a species developing out of another. Huxley said, why, no, of course not. He says, every species is a distinct unit. They can't develop into each other. And Darwin was unable to convince Huxley that there could be such a thing. But Huxley was a bright young fellow, and Darwin enjoyed talking with him and getting ideas that of observations he was making, and he didn't try particularly hard for some time to convert Huxley. You'll see more of Huxley later. Might mention also that Darwin's wife seems to have been rather quite interested in Christian things. He said once, he said, Dad is writing another book. He said, I always feel bad when he writes a book. It makes God seem further away. But Darwin wrote an autobiography in which he had some blasphemous attacks on Christianity and on the Bible. But after his death, these were crossed off. And so his autobiography, as published, did not include them. I think it's been republished lately with them, and everything included. But it probably was his wife who cut out these things. But one day, Darwin received a letter from a still younger friend of his, Alfred Russel Wallace, W-A-L-L-A-C-E. And young Wallace had visited Darwin. He looked up to Darwin, written him a letter occasionally about scientific matters. Wallace was was off in the East Indies, and there he was studying various scientific phenomena, and one day he was taken ill, and he had a few days in bed, and in order to keep his mind occupied, he looked around for books to read, and he came across a copy of Malthus' essay on population. And Wallace read the essay on population, and the thought occurred to him. And he was so thrilled with his thought, he spent 2 or 3 days writing a statement of it, and he wrote a letter to Charles Darwin. He said, I thought of an idea that may explain the change of species. He said, would you please give this to some scientific publication or something and publish it for me, because I think it's worth publication. So Darwin got the letter that Wallace wrote after reading Malthus. Malthus on population. Why, he says, it's almost word for word in many parts like what I wrote 30 years ago that's been in my face and Wallace has never seen. He said, you'd think he was writing a discussion of my own theory. Well, he'd read the same book that Darwin had. You'd think it was a discussion of my own theory. He said to his good friend, he said, what shall I do about this? He said, Wallace will get all the credit for the theory. And Lyle and the others said to him, well, they said, Why don't you present both of them at a meeting of the Linnean Society? Present his, read his paper, and then read yours, and tell them that you wrote this so many years ago. So Darwin did. And he read them at the meeting, and we have the diaries of some of the scientists that were at the meeting, and they say, Charles Darwin read two papers on a rather erudite matter at the meeting. They didn't have any particular interest. It didn't rouse any great excitement. But they said to Darwin, his friend said, now they said, you think your theory is a pretty good one. Wallace has got exactly the same theory he thought of individually. Why don't you proceed to write a book about it now? You've treated Wallace fairly. You've given him full recognition for his idea. Now you write a book and get it out. Don't wait until somebody else does. So he said, well, I can't write my big book. There isn't time. Well, he said, write a small. So he called his book The Origin. The Origin, I forget the exact name, was a long title they had in those days, something like this. The Origin of Species, or the Preservation of Favored Races in the Struggle for Survival, something like that. It was a long title that he gave his book, and he spent about a year or so working over the book. He says, this is only a summary of my evidence. And one of his friends spoke to John Murray, the publisher in Edinburgh, and told him he had a friend here who had written some scientific books, and he'd like to have him publish this book. And Murray looked the book over. Well, he says, he tells quite a lot about pigeons then. So he wrote Darwin. He says, why don't you write a book about pigeons? Everybody's interested in pigeons. Leave out the rest of the book. He said, that would never sell. Well, Darwin had plenty of money. Somebody asked Darwin once, what do you consider your great ability? He said, two. He said, the best abilities I have are two. One is for making general theories, and the other one is for the investment, possibly, of money. And so Darwin had done well in financial ways. He had plenty of money, and he assured them he would see to it they didn't lose anything. If they print the book as it was, they didn't expect to sell very many. But they published the book, and to the amazement of the publisher and of Darwin, the book was an instant success and was discussed everywhere. Now this is the origin of The Origin of Species. How did the book come to have this great success? Well, the reason for the great success, of course, is that the world was ready. The evangelical revival had run its course. It had its great strength the previous century. People were filled now with the heresies built up by the evangelical revival. But belief in the great doctrines on the part of great parts of the population, particularly the educated classes, was waning. Many people were looking for a reasonable reason for turning away from the doctrines that they had been taught. The idea of evolution was no new thing, as we have seen, but particularly was it no new thing now. Because 10 years before, there had been a book written anonymously, which some people had then thought Darwin wrote. And this book was called Vestiges of Creation. It proved later to be written by a man named Chambers, who had published an encyclopedia and wrote on many subjects. And this man in Scotland, Chambers, had taken a year and gone to scientific libraries and studied and written his book, The Vestiges of Creation. And it had been very widely discussed. And The Vestiges of Creation took a very strong stand for the evolution or development of all creatures. Disraeli, the English prime minister, was also a novelist. And Disraeli, in one of his novels, has a section in which the hero of the novel is talking with a woman, and she says, you realize, of course, we're all descended from fish. He says, no, I don't think. Well, she says, first there was a fish, and then there was a tadpole, and then there was a lion. I forget exactly how it went. But she says, it's all proven, she says. If the science has proved it all, we all came through this. Well, he says, I don't think I ever was a fish. Well, that's what the way Disraeli presented in his novel, showing the way quite a large class of people were discussing these ideas 5 or 10 years before the coming out of Darwin's book. We have Darwin's own copy of The Vestiges of Creation. And on the side, he has notes. What nonsense. How absurd. all that sort of thing. He was discussing the book. And Huxley, William Henry Huxley, wrote a review of it in which he attacked it in the most scathing language. It's utterly unscholarly and ridiculous. Some people said it was written by Queen Victoria's husband, the consort Albert. Some discussed various people. There were one or two who suggested maybe Darwin himself was the author. But it was 20 years later before it was told who had written this book. But it went through several editions. People thought, it's absurd. And yet, if there isn't a God, if God didn't create the world, how did it come? Well, it must be some way like this if it did. And yet it doesn't say how it could have happened. How can we believe it? And yet, we don't want to believe this old church stuff. I wish somebody would come with some proof of it. And here came Darwin's book, showing how a simple idea seems to be. Why, we all are different. And then the one type that's different from others, it succeeds better. And consequently, it succeeds and has children, the other gradually dies off, and then gradually get another and another, and thus everything is come. A very simple explanation of the whole universe. Of course, it doesn't go into the question, how do these variations come in the first place? There are variations, no doubt, but how wide are they? Is there a limit beyond which they go? What would make them go clear on so far that a fish would eventually develop into a human being through many intermediate stages? He doesn't take up that question. He goes into this idea with evidences of gradual change under circumstances of environment, which certainly is a true factor in life. 10 years ago, there was hardly a bacteria that penicillin wouldn't kill. Almost any disease, you take penicillin, it kills you right up. Well, penicillin's killed off many of the bacteria. But there are a few bacteria that penicillin doesn't affect. And with the other ones killed off, these are able to survive. They don't have to struggle with the others for their existence so long. They don't have, the penicillin doesn't hurt them. So today we have types of bacteria that penicillin doesn't affect. It's the survival of the one who can endure under those circumstances. There's no question, there's a real principle here. But of course, how far will it go? Will the bacteria that resists penicillin eventually become a man if you give it long enough? That's quite a change. Well, Darwin doesn't go into the question of how the changes occur. But even so, it is my personal guess that Darwin's theory would have had a big splurge and died down and disappeared if it were not for William Henry Huxley. Because Huxley was really the man who made evolution become widely accepted by the younger scientists. The older scientists in England, most of them never accepted. There were very outstanding men in these areas who had made great contributions in these fields, who never accepted evolution. But the younger men were largely won, and to a very great extent, so much that I'm going to make this point number 5, William Henry Huxley. And when we say Huxley, we don't mean Aldous Huxley or Julian Huxley or any of these later descendants of William Henry Huxley. We mean this one. He is the man who we mean when we say Huxley. Because without Huxley, I do not think evolution would have become the force that it has become. Now we've noticed, Huxley didn't accept Darwin's theory. Darwin discussed it with him. Huxley said, I don't see it. He said, every species is separate. But Huxley hated the church. Huxley, as a young man, had to go to church, and he said he listened to interminable long sermons that didn't have much of interest in them. He became thoroughly disgusted with it. He hated it so much that when he was a young man studying anatomy once, he said he could not remember which side of the heart is the mitral valve on. And he had a job remembering. And then he said this occurred to him. Well, a bishop uses a mitre. And he said a bishop couldn't possibly be right. So the mitral valve has got to be on the left side. So that way Huxley always remembered their answer, that the mitral valve was on the left side. Well, he hated the church. But he did not believe that Darwin had sufficient evidence on this. I'm not sure whether he even read Darwin's book in manuscript. He may have. I'm not sure about that. But I know that when Darwin wrote his book, when it was published, one question in his mind was, what's Huxley going to finish? How's he going to take the book? And then a man on one of the leading papers in England was asked to have a review prepared for the book, and he thought of Huxley, whom he'd met somewhere, and he wrote Huxley and asked him to review the book. And Huxley agreed to write the review, and he says that by this time, people who were attacking the Bible on the ground that it would hurt religion, that it contradicted Genesis and so on, Huxley says, when he read the book in manuscript, he now found himself convinced that the book was right. And so he wrote a review which strongly praised the book. And then from that time on, whenever Darwin was asked to speak somewhere, he usually would say, well, let Huxley do it. I'm not well enough to go. Darwin was to receive a medal. Huxley was going to receive it in his place. Darwin called Huxley my general agent, but Huxley called himself Darwin's bulldog. And it was Huxley who engaged in the great debates and the big discussions and who won the day for Darwinism. Yes? What did you say? Now, he had different positions at different times. He was a professor of anatomy at one time, though. But he held different positions at various times. Well, I see you have to stop now. We'll continue our next week.